Good afternoon, Your Honors. Eric Samler, Attorney Registration Number 32349, here on behalf of Mr. Duran. In this case, Mr. Duran was charged by way of indictment with first-degree murder, extreme indifference of a named victim. At the close of evidence, the jury was instructed that they could find Mr. Duran guilty of first-degree murder, extreme indifference of the named victim, or the quote-unquote lesser-included offense of criminal attempt murder, extreme indifference of the named victim. They were instructed as that they were first to consider first-degree murder, extreme indifference, and if they found that people did not prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, they were then to consider criminal attempt of that crime. The difference between those two crimes is, the only difference between those two crimes is not the mens rea, but whether or not the act itself was completed. In this case, whether the named victim died. Unfortunately, here, she did. The jury was also instructed that in addition to considering the charge of first-degree murder, extreme indifference, or attempted first-degree murder, extreme indifference, they were to consider as a lesser non-included offense that of manslaughter. They were told that they could find him guilty of both crimes. They were then instructed that criminal attempt was a lesser included of that than criminal negligence homicide as well. The problem we have here, as far as our argument is that we have a completed crime. And there's two things that I think are wrong here. First, the question is whether or not the attempt should have been instructed at all, since there still needs to be some rational basis for which Mr. Duran could have been acquitted of the greater offense, here would be the first-degree murder, but yet found guilty of the lesser, which would be the attempt. But since we had a completed crime, he could not be found guilty of the attempt itself. The second problem is that reckless manslaughter was instructed as a lesser non-included rather than a lesser included. So we argue that the instruction should have read was that we should have had the first degree murder, extreme indifference, then as a lesser non-included, the reckless, and then the criminal negligent homicide, and they should have been told that they can only find him guilty of one of those crimes, but if they found him guilty of none of those crimes, then they can consider criminal attempt as to each one of those crimes. Which, what we have here is the problem, is that he was convicted of the reckless, which means that the jury necessarily found that he was responsible for the death. Yet they also found that he criminally attempted that death with a different mens rea. This is not only logically inconsistent, it's inconsistent, it's factually inconsistent as well.
Mr. Samler, you didn't argue in your brief inconsistent verdicts. I'm hearing that for the first time.
No, I believe I did, Your Honor.
You did?
I believe I did.
You mentioned that they were inconsistent in the sense that one is a non-included as instructed here when in reality it's an included offense. But I don't remember you arguing that it was an inconsistency in the verdicts that we had to reconcile. Maybe I'm incorrect.
Maybe I'm incorrect too, and I'll obviously have an opportunity to look at my brief and we can deal with that.
Let me ask you this. You said you didn't think that there was a rational basis to acquit of the murder charge but yet convict of attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't there be a rational basis if the jury believed that the first five shots, one of those was what killed the victim, and the second five shots were fired by Mr. Duran and didn't kill the victim, but he'd still be liable for attempt?
Well, perhaps it'd be two different counts here. The problem is we have one act here. He was charged with causing the death of this individual, causing death of this poor girl. Yet because of firing into the house, he was either complicit in the firing into the house or he was a principal in the firing of the house. I don't know. There was some dispute as to whether or not he fired into the house at all. Be that as it may, I don't know what the jury found. We don't know if the jury found him as a complicit or a principal. But what we have here then is a complete constructive amendment of the charges and saying we're going to charge you with two different acts here. We're going to charge you with causing the death and attempting to cause the death at the same time. Yet we have obviously have a problem that somebody caused the death of this individual. If he was complicit in the death, which he would have been for the reckless manslaughter, then that's what he was. He was complicit. He can't be found guilty as both a complicit in the reckless manslaughter and then guilty as a principal in the attempt, which is exactly what would have happened here under that scenario. So either he's a complicit or he's a principal.
Counsel, the attempt is always a lesser included of a crime. and the distinction seemed to be whether there is a rational basis to acquit of the greater and convict on the lesser. Is that essentially what you're arguing? I mean, there really can't be an argument that it's not legally a lesser included.
Of course it's legally a lesser included. I'm not arguing that it's not. But simply the fact that it's a lesser included does not mean that it necessarily needs to be given in this case. In fact, if there's no rational basis, it shouldn't be given. If in fact the situation is that is always given regardless of whether there's rational basis, then the court has to basically say that there's carte blanche, that a defendant's always entitled to a tenth regardless. And that's not the case law.
How do you deal with the statute that says that the impossibility to complete the crime is not a defense to criminal attempt?
Okay. In this situation, if they were properly instructed that he was in first-degree murder, extreme indifference, reckless manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, and the jury found him guilty of not guilty of none of those, but found him guilty of attempt, I don't think I'd have argument pursuant to the statute. The problem we have here, that's what I think that statutory language means, that the jury could have found him guilty of attempt at that point in time. The problem we have here is that they found him also guilty of the completed crime, albeit at a lesser grade than the first-degree murder. So that's what I think that part of the language in the statute actually means. What I'd like to touch on, since I only have a few minutes before rebuttal, is jump over, if the court doesn't have any more questions on that, on the self-defense instruction, which I believe was improper as well. There are a couple of reasons that I think that the self-defense instruction was improper as well. We all know that self-defense is not an affirmative defense to the crimes where the mens rea is either extreme indifference, reckless, or criminally negligent homicide. However, a defendant can still raise that evidence of the self-defense to negate an element of the crime, namely the required mens rea, be it extreme indifference or be it reckless behavior. The problem here is twofold. First, the jury was instructed that they may consider evidence of self-defense. But that is necessarily them that it's not, they're not required to do so. Yet, in this situation, if he was acting in reasonable self-defense, since the court found that there was factual basis to give that instruction, then the jury could, if they could, find him guilty of this crime, even though people did not prove all the elements of the crime, namely the necessary mens rea. Because if he was acting in reasonable self-defense, then he wasn't acting in extreme indifference, or he wasn't acting recklessly.
The statute uses the term may, doesn't it?
It does.
Why, if we normally allow instructions in the language of the statute, why is this a problem?
Well, just because normally we allow it, and a division of this court in Lara clearly recognized that there was a problem here, because by just using the word may, what's happening here is that you can still find him guilty even though the people have not proven all the elements of the crime. And the fact that there's a legal maxim that says that the statute is written that way and therefore it's necessarily okay to give it doesn't trump a defendant's right to be that the people must prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
This is a plain error issue, is it not?
It's a plain error issue at all with regard to self-defense.
Was there an objection?
Yes, there was objection.
I withdraw that, counsel. I'm thinking of some other issue in the case.
Yeah, there was not. I acknowledge that with the whole bit with the attempt and the reckless and how all that came to be. First, none of that's on the record, and that must have happened in chambers. So I have no idea how that all came to be. There was no objection to that on the record. As far as the self-defense, there was argument with regard to that, and in the end, Mr. Duran's attorney just said that we object to the whole instruction as it's given. So I think that's properly preserved. And if the court doesn't have any more questions right now, I'd like to reserve the rest of the time.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Berman, registration number 35882, and I represent the people in this matter. The defendant raises a myriad of arguments trying to vacate the attempted extreme indifference murder conviction some of them raised for the first time in the reply brief, like inconsistent verdicts, which is nowhere in the opening brief. And none of those arguments succeed. The basic premise of his arguments is that the defendant cannot stand convicted of the attempt because the victim actually died. But that argument does not stand under the, as a matter of law, nor under the facts of this case. This case is unique in that there were two shooters. They both used the same gun within a matter of seconds. They fired 10 bullets at the house. One of those bullets struck the victim, and it was inconclusive from the evidence presented which defendant fired the fatal shot. From that evidence, there is a rational basis for the jury to acquit the defendant of extreme indifference murder, but convict him of the attempt.
Ms. Berman, can you tell us why the verdicts wouldn't be inconsistent, or what's your position on that issue?
Sure. And again, I would have greatly appreciated a chance to write about it in the answer brief. But inconsistent verdicts, as I understand it, are those verdicts that are legally and logically inconsistent to the extent that an element of one crime negates a necessary element of the other crime. And that's not the case here. The fact that reckless manslaughter has an element of caused the death of another person does not negate anything in attempted extreme indifference murder, because if the defendant caused the death of another person, here the victim, that can constitute the substantial step towards committing extreme indifference murder. And again, the fact that the crime was completed is not in any way a defense to the attempt. So those two are not legally and logically inconsistent at all. And I would also say that even if they were, the remedy is not to get rid of attempted extreme indifference murder. The remedy is to maximize the verdicts. And here,
how do we do that, Ms. Berman? How would we maximize those two?
If you feel it's necessary to maximize the verdicts, it's the reckless manslaughter conviction that would be vacated. It is the lesser conviction. Here, the defendant got 48 years on attempted extreme indifference murder. It is the greater offense, and he only got 3 years on reckless manslaughter.
As long as you're rebutting the reply, would you also let us know whether or not you have a position on the supplemental authority that was offered?
Yes, I do have a position. I don't understand the relevancy of it, to be frank. The Brown case deals with a defendant's request for a lesser included instruction on, I believe it's second-degree murder, where first-degree murder was charged. And the issue is whether that lesser included offense is inconsistent with the defendant's claim of innocence. And I just don't see the relevance here. Here you have attempted extreme indifference murder being presented as a lesser included offense. I don't see the defendant. I don't think he was the one who presented it. So it's just not, the case isn't on par with this.
Can I direct your attention to the contention that the evidence is insufficient to support the reckless manslaughter conviction?
Sure.
What I want to focus on is the evidence that supports the finding that defendant Duran fired the shot that killed the victim.
Okay.
What evidence is there to show that he, as principal, fired the shot that killed the victim? Isn't the evidence undisputed that the second five shots couldn't have killed the victim?
No, it's not undisputed at all.
Why is that?
There were 10 shots. It was conclusive that five of the shots were fired by Montoya, the co-defendant, in the yard. And then they run to the car, and the defendant fires the second five shots from the street. Of the 10 shots fired from that gun, five of them hit the window of hit the bedroom window where the victim was located. So one of them went through the window and hit the victim. Four of the others hit the area of the window. The evidence showed that Montoya was not the one who fired all five of those shots. Montoya is the one who shot his friend Edward Chavez, as testified to by Edward Chavez's girlfriend, who saw the bullet hit him. Furthermore, I believe the defendant's I can't remember if it's all of the experts or just the defendant's expert testified that there were there was a bullet found in a bag of leaves, and that most likely was fired by Montoya because of the placement in the leaves and the fact that he was in the yard. So those are two shots of the five fired by Montoya that were not directed to the window. That means the defendant had to have fired at least two of the shots at the window. One of them easily could have been the shot that killed the victim.
Talk about that for a minute, because we have undisputed evidence that the victim's head wound was 55 inches from her heel.
Right.
And we have undisputed evidence, I think, that once she went down on the floor during the first volley of shots, she never got back up.
And I believe that evidence is, in fact, disputed. There were three witnesses who talked about the victim's placement in the bedroom at the time of the shots. Now, Matt Barton, the host of the party, he testified that he went in there and told everyone, somebody's got a gun, get on the floor, and that the victim got up from the sofa and got to the floor. Now, he argued that she never stood fully erect, that she simply went from the sitting position to the floor. So based on that evidence alone, it seems that the victim was never standing high enough during that first volley of shots to be hit by a bullet.
What evidence do we have to show that the angle of the shot could have hit her while she was on the floor? Any? Any evidence?
I don't know that we have conclusive evidence one way or the other. I do think all of the experts said it's most likely that she was standing up, but I don't think any of them said she absolutely was standing up. I will also point out that Matt Barton gave an indication of where everyone was in the room, and that was contested by two of the other people who were witnesses. One of them, the victim's friend Leah, Matt Barton had said she never got up off of the floor until both rounds of gunfire were over, and she said she actually stood up after the first round of gunfire. So it's very possible that the victim did as well.
Wait a minute. Possibilities can't be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Probabilities can. Do we have any evidence at all that the victim got up off the floor? We have Leah saying she got up off the floor, mm-hmm. but no evidence that the victim ever did.
Well, I think it's a reasonable inference for the jury to determine that she got up off the floor based on Matt Barton's testimony that when she first went down to the floor from the sofa, she did so in a manner where she put her hands over her head, and he said that she did so of her own volition, and that if she were shot in the head, presumably that wouldn't be the case. And so the first time that she goes down on the floor does not appear to be the time that she was shot. If there are no more questions on that issue, I'd like to move on to the self-defense instruction. I argue that the defendant did not preserve this issue at all. The defendant's objection to the entire instruction was vague and imprecise. It did not give specific grounds at all for why he was objecting, and it's simply insufficient to preserve an objection to this issue.
The trial court was alerted to the issue, at least by Montoya's counsel.
The trial court was alerted to the issue of the provocation and initial aggressor exceptions. It was not alerted to any challenge to the language of the statute itself. Montoya's counsel, in fact, told the trial court, asked the trial court to instruct the jury in the language of the statute, and further asked the trial court to instruct the jury a person is justified in using physical force. Now, the language of the statute itself uses the challenged may consider language. And then here you also have Montoya's counsel asking the trial court to instruct the jury with the justified language. And you can find that in volume two of the 06 CA 1875 case, which is, that volume is shared with this case. That's at pages 25 and 30.
So I've looked at that. Record clear who?
I don't think the record is clear who intended which instruction, but at the what little instructional conference is on the record, you do have Montoya asking the trial court to instruct the jury in the language of the statute, and again, that includes the may consider language, and then otherwise asking the court to give language with that justified term in it. So Montoya didn't preserve that issue at all, neither did the defendant. And so if any error, and I would argue that there isn't, first of all, Lara is completely silent on this issue of whether the phrases may consider or whether justify our error. But even if they were error in this case, they were not plain error. They were not obvious at the time that the trial court instructed the jury. This case came out before Lara was announced. And so at the time that the jury was instructed, it was reasonable for the trial court to believe that an instruction in the language of the statute was completely appropriate. It was not until the Lara case that that came into question whether the language of the statute should be used in an instruction. If there are no more questions on this, I would ask that you...
I do have some questions for you, if I may. I want to direct your attention to the instruction on reckless manslaughter being a lesser non-included.
Yes.
You admit that's wrong.
I admit that's wrong.
Why is it not plain error?
It is not plain error under the... I would say under the analysis that the defendant presents, which is that it somehow infringed on the jury's consideration of extreme indifference murder. It's not plain error in that sense.
Well, if the jury obviously thought that the defendant acted with a lesser degree of culpability when it convicted him of reckless manslaughter, didn't it?
I don't think we can presume what the jury believed. I think that this verdict seems to be a compromise verdict.
So, if the jury had been instructed it had a choice among the three crimes or the attempts, as opposed to finding not only extreme indifference or attempted extreme indifference, but also reckless
right.
attempt, etc., wouldn't the jury have been able to pick one as opposed to both?
I think we should presume the jury would have picked the attempted extreme indifference murder. It's the greater offense. I do believe that a bridge instruction was given on that so that the jury was told you were not to consider this until you acquit the defendant of, until and if you acquit the defendant of extreme indifference murder. So therefore it would have gone
so.
On.
I think the record indicates quite clearly that they instructed the jury to consider reckless manslaughter in addition.
No, absolutely. I do agree with that. I'm just saying that had it been properly instructed, it would have considered attempted extreme indifference murder first, being the greater offense, and then it would have stopped there.
Well, the standard is if there's a reasonable possibility that it affected the verdict, reversal is mandated. Do you agree with that? That's what
I agree with that standard. I don't think there was a reasonable possibility here. I mean, it calls into question the defendant's conviction for reckless manslaughter, but I don't think it calls into question at all his conviction for attempted extreme indifference murder, again, because the jury would have considered that first. And had they been properly instructed that it was a lesser included, that reckless manslaughter was a lesser included, and it was not to consider that until it acquitted of the greater offenses, the defendant would still stand convicted of attempted extreme indifference murder.
Under that rationale, wouldn't you have to vacate the reckless manslaughter?
No, I don't believe so, because the defendant wasn't prejudiced by the instruction, and I do believe that that's the standard on whether you get resentencing or not, is whether the defendant was prejudiced, and he hasn't demonstrated any prejudice here from the jury additionally considering reckless manslaughter. If there are no more questions, I would ask that this court affirm the defendant's convictions. Thank you.
Sandler, before you begin your argument, can you just briefly address the harm to your client? Well, the prosecution takes a position that there wasn't.
Well, the harm to my client is that if the jury was properly instructed, if they were, the jury would never have reached attempt whatsoever. With all due respect, I've been practicing law now for 25 years, and I have never seen a jury instructed this way. The jury in my view is always instructed with regard to the substantive crimes of murder, reckless manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, or murder for second degree murder, whatever, and then instructed with regard to the attempt. And then they're further instructed that if you don't find that they were proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he actually committed the substantive crime, do you consider the inchoate crime of attempt? So what happened here was that the jury was told that you can convict him of both. And therefore, if they were told that he can only convict them of one, I believe what would have happened here, since they found that Mr. Duran was responsible
from the death, that they would have convicted him of that level of homicide. That's what I believe is the harm here. A couple of things. Judge Casebelt, you're right. I did not address the issue of inconsistent verdict, and for that, I apologize if I brought that up. I did not address that at all in the brief. The other issue is with regard to People v. Brown. I do believe it is relevant to this case for a couple of reasons. First of all, they cite to Apodaca v. People, and therefore, in essence, reaffirm that case. And in Apodaca, the court held that a defendant was not entitled to an attempt instruction when it was undisputed that the crime was completed. And the only dispute was whether or not that individual was responsible for the crime. So I do think it is relevant. Further, in Brown, the fact that the facts of the case, yes, are different, but the reality is that what it holds is that a court can instruct on inconsistent verdicts, you know, that, but there still needs to be a rational basis before the court can do so. Do you have a question?
Thank you.
A couple of things. Where were we? As far as the evidence of whether or not the victim died the first volley of shots, I do believe it is undisputed that that's what happened. There was a hole in the screen at 45 inches from the base of the house. The evidence was that she went down and she never got back up. There was no evidence whatsoever presented that at any point in time that she got back up. And obviously, once she went down, the bullet hit her at that point in time, and that thus therefore it was Mr. Montoya that was responsible for those shots. And where that leaves us is that in no way, there's no evidence presented whatsoever that Mr. Duran was in any way complicit in that at all, because he had no knowledge. There's no evidence presented that he had any knowledge or had any intent to assist Mr. Montoya during that first round of shots. If there are no more questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.